You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. My dear friend Rob is
here. Hi, Michael.
Hollis.
Who do we have today?
We have a guy that I love, a co-creator of The Office.
Yep, he's one of my favorite comedians.
Stephen Merchant, dude. This guy is amazing. We talk about so much great stuff on the show.
He did Extras also, and he did Hello Ladies on HBO, which was canceled way too soon.
And he's, by the way, a great actor. This guy's a really good actor, and I think he's going to do a lot of serious stuff in the future, so I'm no Nostradamus, but I'll tell you something, my brother.
Nostradamus?
Whatever, dog. This is going to happen. He's a really talented guy, and he's a really nice guy, too.
And you know him from your show that was canceled.
Well, his girlfriend now, she was on Impastor, and thank you for bringing that up. Mm-hmm. But Mercedes, I said, hey, Mercedes, anything I shouldn't talk about? She's like, well, I don't talk about his height, maybe. First thing he talks about is his height. But I love this story about Ricky Gervais. I love how they met. I love that whole thing. He's just a force to be reckoned with, man. This guy is a genius, but listen, and you'll learn a lot.
Yeah, he's got a movie coming out in a little bit called The Girl in the Spider's Web.
I think it's The Spider Web. Well, apostrophe S, huh?
Yeah.
Gotta go smart on
it.
And
it comes out November 9th.
Oh, man.
Which is really soon.
Inside of You is sponsored by ADT. That's not to be confused with my ADD.
Or ADHD.
This is eight. Do you think I have that too?
Who knows? I'm not a doctor.
This is ADT, and I will tell you what these guys do, because they've been providing alarms security service for me for 14 years, Rob.
Yeah, my brother actually worked for ADT for a little while.
Really?
Yeah.
Did he love it?
He did. He's his old security system.
He likes helping people.
Yep.
They make it easy for you, folks. I mean, these guys, it's such an easy thing to use, and I feel protected at night. All the windows have little alarms on at the doors, in case you're thinking about breaking into my house. Don't fucking do it.
Well, you're kind of a scared guy.
Yeah, I watched horror movies. My mom made me watch, like, Motel Hell and make them die slowly when I was 8. So I sleep with a bat next to my bed, 2 dogs, alarm system, spike gates. I put booby traps in my house in case anybody does break in.
Well, now you don't need to do that because you have an ADT alarm system.
Well, I do that, and I use ADT.
Oh, well.
So now I feel really protected. But ADT, yeah, you know, anytime, you know, the alarm goes off, you know, somebody's calling me within a minute going, hey, is everything all right? Or they send someone over. ADT will set up your home with multiple smart home devices, security features like indoor, outdoor cameras, locks, lights, garage door control, even video doorbells. It's pretty incredible, and it's important that you have an alarm system if you have anything of value in the house. Your life. Thank you, Rob.
Or your kid's life.
Yeah, you have a child.
Yep.
You have ADT?
I will, after visiting ADT.com/smart to learn about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
ADT.com/smart?
Yep, that's it.
All right, Stephen Merchant, have a listen.
It's my point of view. Listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Do you have a lot of theater training?
No, I did a play a couple of years ago and didn't get on with it. Turns out you have to say the same thing every night.
See, that's my problem with, I think, everything.
Right.
If you get a series, you realize after the pilot you have to continue with the series and the role.
Do the same thing.
Don't you say after 5-10 episodes, you ever get like, oh my God, I'm still playing this guy?
I don't think I've ever been in a show that's lasted that long.
That's not true.
Out of choice, sometimes.
Really?
Well, in the UK, you don't do long runs of things on the whole. Or if you do, you only do sort of, you know, 6 episodes at a time or something.
Is there a reason for that?
Economics. We don't have anything like syndication in the UK, so, you know, you don't have the kind of money, so therefore you can have teams of writers, so therefore how can you generate, you know, 10, 20
so
episodes?
So you just don't make a lot of money.
You don't make a lot of money and you don't make a lot of episodes, yeah, except, say, long-running soap operas.
Yeah, I walked outside this morning and I see this water and power truck, and then behind them is another one, and you are lodged somewhere in between.
Yes.
Coming up the hill. But you had a nice smile on your face, like, here I am.
Well, I was pleased because you'd come out of your house to greet me, that you could see why I was late.
Were you late?
I was late by 10 minutes, and I don't like being late, but I realized you had seen what had happened.
I shook my head looking
at... It was the perfect excuse.
Oh, my gosh. And there was this guy on top of it, this behind the truck, right? There was a guy just, like, bobbing up and down on the back like he was on a go-kart or something.
And it was moving at maybe 2 miles an hour.
Yeah.
My grandmother used to refer to the merchant luck. And over the years, I've realized the merchant luck, and she used to mean that in a negative way, that we had bad luck. my family. But actually, I think we do, but it's very minor bad luck. It's things like that. You're on your way to an appointment, you get stuck behind really slow water and tree cutting equipment or something.
Service, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's quite specific.
But so you have some bad luck, but it's not real bad
exactly.
luck.
It's just minor.
It's like you sprain your ankle on a run.
That's it. Exactly.
It's the merchant
exactly.
luck.
It's like you
You're
were generally
lose
healthy.
Your leg.
We generally have been lucky in our lives. You know, we're not we've got a fairly easy run, but just minor frustrations.
Stephen Merchant, thank you for allowing me to be inside of you today.
Please, I welcome you in.
Do you know? That was a good reply. That's the first I welcome you in we've had, right, Rob? Yep. He's not a microphone. Doesn't matter. How do we meet? Do you remember?
We met, as I recall, via an agent.
I think it was via an agent.
Now, I can't remember. Were we?
Do you remember the agent's name? I'm no longer with him.
Yeah, Richard Weitz.
Are you with him?
I am.
You are still with Richard Weitz. I think you were directly with him.
Yeah.
And I was
tangentially.
Yes, there was another agent there, which left the agency. I left, which, you know. But he took us out. Did we go to a game?
I think we went to some kind of sporting event.
Was it a Dodger game?
Yes. Is that baseball?
That's baseball.
Yes, I believe that
was what
we did.
How long have you lived in Los Angeles?
I'm a big baseball fan, as you can tell.
You are.
And so we went there. And then on the way back, do you remember he pulled in and took us to Universal Studios? Like we were sort of the children of a divorced parent.
That's true. And, it was like Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah.
And we didn't have tickets. So our super agent went up and said, I said, what are you going to do? Well, he's going to the box office. He's going to talk to the manager and say, I'm with two guys who are celebrities.
Right.
But really, no one really knew us that
well. They didn't know. But do you remember a lot of his angle was that we worked for NBC?
Or is at least that what he said?
Yeah, he was saying, was your show on NBC?
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay. Well, he was talking about how I was involved with The Office and that was on NBC,
right.
Universal. And
but it worked.
That was, and it somehow he. But what you realize is if you have the chutzpah of an agent to go up to a 21-year-old kid working the gate at Universal Studios and just talk at them with great authority, they let you in.
And I remember you were, you know, when I met you, you were very, you have such a calmness about you. You're incredibly funny. It's like I sort of just keep saying things hoping they're funny.
You're throwing shit at the wall, seeing what sticks.
Exactly. And you sort of, I'm not to say you're more calculating, but you choose not to say as much. And when you say something, it's usually funny.
It's precision engineering. I'll tell you what it is. It's sometimes nerves. I think that when I first meet people, I often, I have a fear of coming over as as overbearing or I don't know. I think I've learned over the years to be more socially adept, but I don't think it comes naturally.
I think it's a defense mechanism for me. I feel like I've always felt like I'm the guy that just you don't accept this guy, but then you realize, oh, he's kind of funny.
Right.
Like, okay, look. Oh, this guy's he's got good energy. He's fun.
Yes.
Instead of just like I feel fear if I'm quiet, if I just don't do too much, I'll just be overlooked and ignored.
Yes. Maybe I don't mind that.
Being ignored.
Possibly. Do you know what it is? Sometimes I wonder, I think when you're very tall from a young age, you draw attention whether you want it or not. And a lot of actors like attention and go into performing for attention. Weirdly, I got attention just by virtue of being tall. And I think perhaps performing was a way of controlling that attention. Deciding when people laugh at you, deciding when people look at you a little bit more, or at least being in control.
So you always had people looking at you. You always felt like you were different, like you were odd, you were standing out. You didn't want to stand out.
Right, because when you're a teenager, I think that you either want to blend in and fit in, or you want to mark yourself out from the crowd for attention. And I think I probably wanted to fit in and was forced to stand out by virtue of being 6'7".
Well, I was 6'7". Yeah, I was the opposite. I was the smallest kid in my high school.
Oh,
so I stood out in the other way.
Yeah.
You know, if you and I went to high school together, maybe that would have been a really great TV show. You know?
I think I would just, that would have been finally someone I could bully.
Jesus, Stephen. In this environment, that's where you want to go. You would be like, finally.
Well.
You could pick up the smallest kid. Did you get picked on? Did you feel
Not
like,
really.
Since you were tall, that they were like, oh, tall guy, huh? Come on, tough guy, let's do this.
No, I never got that. In fact, a lot of the bullies in my school were so dumb, they never even clocked on to the idea that they could pick on me for being tall. It was like they'd choose other things. Hey, guy with glasses. It's like, okay, but a lot of people have glasses. So
right.
I'm the 6'7" guy. Go for beanpole. Come on, guys.
Did you play sports? Were you athletic?
No.
You didn't want to play sports.
I just wasn't very adept at it. People would obviously say, and they still do you play basketball?
I mean, because if I was that tall, I'd play basketball.
Yeah, basketball's not as big a thing in the UK.
Yeah, that's true. Did you play soccer?
Poorly.
Don't they call it football?
That's right. Because we use our feet to kick the ball rather than pick it up and run with it.
Oh, yeah, that makes sort of makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think it does.
You can see I'm a big sports fan.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, you didn't know that we went to see the Dodgers, the baseball team. That's okay. That's okay. Were you, as a child, did you feel like you were more the guy that goes upstairs and reads a book?
Yes.
Is that because your parents were like that? Did they have good, like, sort of... I mean, were they always reading? Were they always, like, educating
they
you?
Weren't, they weren't...
Be smart.
They weren't overly educated people themselves. They were working class people who were smart and are smart. And there was always books in the house. And actually, bizarrely, my mother used to buy and sell books kind of secondhand. So there's always books around. And I think she encouraged, both of them encouraged that. And I think I don't think they had to push me to do it. I think I was just drawn to it for whatever reason.
Do you feel like maybe it was an escape?
I certainly was a big comic book fan when I was younger.
Really?
You know, all the trappings of the classic nerd was me.
What were your favorite comics?
Batman and Superman.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm. You know, I played Lex Luthor.
Yeah. No, I didn't know that. The problem with your Smallville show was that he wasn't Superman yet. So, like, why am I interested? You know, I want to see the cape and the tights and everything.
Because for the first time in television history, we were telling the story before the story.
Absolutely.
It was about how did he get evil? How did he get good? How did he become Superman? But for you, you didn't have the interest.
I already knew. I already knew how it happened.
You read the comics.
There you are.
You want to see Superman.
I want to see him.
But they had Superman and Lois and Clark. They had Gene Hackman.
Oh, well, no, Lois and Clark I was a big fan of. I loved that show. Because they were already Superman. He was Superman.
Pardon my vernacular, but fuck you, Steven. Rob, did you watch...
Smallville, no.
Did you read comics?
Not really, no.
Were you popular in school?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay.
I don't think I was... I wasn't unpopular. It wasn't that by virtue of reading and being interested in comic books, I was unpopular. I just wasn't... I was sort of... I was nowhere particularly. You know, I was not popular or unpopular... I was fine. I got
you were just
by.
There.
I was
you
just
were just
there.
Kind of that. That's. I felt like I was there. A solid presence.
You know, just like I was. You know, oh, there he is. But it wasn't.
Were
no
you
one was
funny?
Excited.
Were you people? Did they find you
yes.
amusing?
I was funny. I was funny. Or I think I used. Yes. Once I kind of found that tool, then I used that to the point where it became, I think, probably annoying. In fact, you mentioned about that idea of when we first met, not coming out all guns blazing. And I actually think probably if you'd met me as a teenager, I was a bit more exhausting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think I was trying to be funny all the time in a desperate attempt to use my one asset. And I think probably at some point I realized this is tiring.
Yeah, I think for me it's like sometimes if people don't laugh, if they're different, the energy's different, I assume, oh, they just don't like me.
Right.
And that's an insecurity. Right. That's something I've worked on. Like, hey, not everybody's going to react the way you want them to. Not everybody in the room is going to love your joke.
Right.
You're not going to sell it everywhere. And I read some article where you were interviewed where they said something about, you know, when you're doing a project, when you're writing a project, you can't think of some guy for the Telegraph, what he's going to think of what you're right. writing. You just write on instinct.
Of course. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that was sort of profound. I mean, it was simple.
Yeah.
But it was profound because that's sort of like when you have an idea and you think something's funny, you write it.
Right.
You don't say to a million, look, you ask some of your close friends, do you think this is funny?
Sure.
Do you think this is funny? Do you ask people, is this funny? Or do you go, this is funny, I'm writing it and this is going to stay. I'm not going to even ask anybody if this line is funny.
Well, I think it depends on what you're writing it for. If you're writing it for stand-up, for instance, if you do stand-up, then you know you're going to be told if it's funny pretty damn quick when you get on the stage. So then you've got the perfect test because if the room doesn't go with it, and you can try that 3 or 4 nights and if it doesn't work, it's not funny or something's a screw's loose in that particular bit.
Right.
So that's easy. That's a kind of, that's a basic, you know, litmus test.
Instant gratification
exactly.
or not.
Right. When you're writing a project sort of, and you're just, you know, kind of bunkered away writing, I agree it's much harder. So there I would get people to read it and tell me. I would love it if someone would go through a script and just tick and, you know, put a check and a mark against what they thought was funny. And not, I think just a binary decision like that.
Just instead of explaining why?
Exactly.
Just say, yeah, not funny.
Just boom, no, ding, yeah.
But then there's probably this competitive spirit in you that wants to go, okay, not funny, huh? I'm going to write that again. I'm going to make that joke funny. And you're going to keep going? Are you like that? Are you
no,
like,
I don't have that. I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm not going to compromise it or change it based on the whims of other people, but I will listen and be guided by other other opinions that I trust. Otherwise, it's very hard to work in a vacuum.
Have you dealt with a lot of failure in your life? Because it seems like I read is success stories. And people assume Office, Extras, all these movies now. You're a real actor. You're you know, you've done it all. You've done radio. You've done. And so it's like stand up that they only associate probably success, confidence.
Right.
This guy knows what he's doing. There's no. Do you still feel insecure? Do you still feel moments of like, oh, man, I don't belong?
Do you know, in recent years, for the first time, I've started feeling like, oh, I'm a professional at this. Yeah, I know what I'm doing now. Maybe it's turning 40. So, something where I felt, you know, I'm an adult. You know, yeah, you can bring me into the room. I know what I'm talking about. I'm not always going to get it right.
So there are other times when you remember being in a room going, oh, fucking, I can't. I'm so nervous. Or I don't feel comfortable. I don't. These executives, they're wearing ties.
Yes. I think that. I think assuming other people were pros. You know, if you spend enough time in Hollywood, if you work with enough people, particularly people you admire, you realize everyone's just figuring it out. Everyone's making it up as they go along. There's no, you know, when you're a kid, you look at people you admire, whether it's Steven Spielberg or whoever, and you sort of think they're just another breed of person. And then, you know, once you get to meet those people, they're super talented, but they have their own doubts or their own processes or their own questions or their assholes or they're not, or they're, you know, and so at some point, once you realize that, you're like, oh, no one's the perfect person, no one's got it all figured out, no one has lacks insecurity. So,
and that's comforting, isn't it?
That's very, it's enormously comforting.
Yeah, I like to see, not to see people fail, but to know that other people have insecurities, that they have fears, that they have, that no one's got it,
no one's got it all figured out,
right? None. But and you said something, what did you say? You said something about one of your heroes just now, and when you meet your heroes at the rest, I read something about that. You met one of your heroes, and they weren't kind.
Who did I name the person?
Maybe that was another Stephen.
David Bowie.
I read that you read someone who you admired, and they were kind of an asshole to you.
I did that. That happened a few times when I was much younger, before I really got into the business, when I was still at college or I remember one comedian in particular that I admired.
That's what it was, a comedian.
Yeah, and then I sort of met that person just as I was starting out my career, and they were kind of a dick. And I remember being quite taken aback by it. And years later, realizing it was their insecurity that led to them being aggressive.
What was it? Do you think, like, I always say when, you know, if someone tells me, you know, I grew up in Indiana, and they'll say, hey, how's so-and-so? I bet they're an asshole. Or I heard so-and-so is a dick.
Right.
And I'm like, well, I like to give the benefit of the doubt.
Of course.
Because everybody, look, if you have a bad day, maybe someone's sister just died. Maybe you just got in a car wreck. Maybe and someone comes up to you, hey, I can't right now. And like, oh my God, that guy's an asshole.
Yeah.
Now, was this particular moment with the comedian, was it something different?
No,
I
think subsequent, I don't want to name the person.
Yeah, you don't have
to. But subsequently, I've had enough evidence from other people in the business that it wasn't a one-off situation, and that person's known for a kind of a certain misanthropic or malevolent attitude.
Who's the first person, who's the one person you were excited to meet? And then realize, wow, they're better than I thought. This is such a great, this is an amazing individual here. So happy this person's kind.
Well, I have to say, I was all the people that we had on Extras were terrific. Ben Stiller and Sir Ian McKellen and all those people. Just, you know, I think the thing that I was reassured by and what I was heartened by was when you meet people that you admire and you just, they're just fucking professionals. You know what I mean? You're in a work capacity and they just deliver and they're good to work with. They understand, they get it.
They know their lines.
They know it and they're there to work and they're there to do the thing. And it's not about starriness or attitude or, you know, or power plays or...
I'm sure you've had it.
We've had that stuff. But, you know, but that, I remember just, you know, that's exciting. You know, working with people that you admire and just see and learning from, like... I remember we did this movie with Ralph Fiennes.
Ooh.
And Ralph Fiennes was brilliant. But one thing I realized was, like, he's an utter pro, but what he also does, which is magnificent, is when you're shooting a scene with Ralph, he gives you variations on every take, but they're never so varied that they couldn't all cut together. So you get in the editing room and you've got all this nuance, but they're just shades of the same color. So you've got more angry and less angry and more funny and less funny, and you can just mold them all together in a hole. And I'm just like, wow. Whereas previously as an actor, I'm just throwing everything out there. Yeah. Like, and then you get in the editing room and you're like, this doesn't make any, this, you know, I'm at a 10 there, I'm at a 5 in this bit, and right. this doesn't work. We have to make it, we have to choose one.
Right.
Whereas Rafe just gave us such nuanced variety. And I've, ever since then, I've tried to learn from that. I mean, whether I've succeeded,
I don't
know.
Do you do a lot of, do you try to, so do different takes?
Exactly.
You like that. That's what I like to do. Just mix it up a little bit.
Right. But it's no good. I think what I learned from Rafe was you can't be wayward with it. You can't be kind of unchecked.
Outside the box.
No, you've got to, it's all still got to work.
Within that character's perimeters, right.
Exactly. So I don't know where we got onto that. But anyway, just learning from that, admiring people and then learning from their skills, I find thrilling.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know I love BetterHelp. They've been around here a long time. And I am convinced that therapy is such an important part of our lives. The stigma, I think, is going away. And more people are veering towards therapy and helping themselves. Because it's all about the future. You know, if you can work on yourself now, you're going to be a better, stronger person later. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, folks, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. Therapy with BetterHelp is just a good place to start when you want to understand you better. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. And all you do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/inside today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/inside. Inside of You is brought to you by Shopify. If you haven't used Shopify and you're starting your own business, I don't know who you are. I don't even want to talk to you because Shopify is so easy to use. It is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. And it's so easy to manage and navigate. For instance, on Talkville and Inside of You, I do it all. I see what the best product selling is. I see what's the least product selling is. I can easily check how much money I've made for the month. It's easy to add a product. It's all so simple. I can do it. It's right there for you. It's just so easy to use. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere.
From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms.
And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/inside, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/inside now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/inside. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. I mean, did you think you wanted to be an actor when you're growing up in England? And was your mom a nurse?
She was a nursery nurse working with kids.
And a nursery nurse.
Yeah, but she was mainly at home when I was growing up. I was more interested in doing comedy. I never thought of myself as an actor, but more as a, I guess maybe as a comic actor. I thought that would be appealing.
Like, and that was in high school, even.
Mm-hmm.
And then after high school, what happened?
I went to university where I studied film and literature, essentially two leisure pursuits. And while there, did radio for the first time, right. Did live stage work for the first time.
And how'd that start? Do you remember your first time on stage?
Well, I'd done a school play in high school, and that had gone well. And I'd been
well
received.
What character? What play?
It was written by the teachers.
Oh, yeah.
And in one, I played a sort of comedy reverend. I was judging a dance contest. It was set in the sort of 1950s. And I remember I had to read a list every night. I'd have to open this envelope and announce the winner of the contest. And so I 14 or something when I did this. And so I, on the first night, I opened the envelope and I said, and the winner is 2 pints of milk, eggs, tampons. I'm sorry. That's a grocery list. And, you know, when parents have been dragged along to see a school play, if there's anything even resembling a joke, they're going to laugh at it, right? Because they can't believe their luck.
Sure.
So they went wild for this. I mean, it was pretty
lame. So every night
lame.
You mixed it up?
Every night I mixed it up. And by the third night, the teacher who'd written the play, I think probably sort of only semi-seriously, would kind of, where's Merchant? He's changed the lines again. And I felt like I was this rebel. You know, someone who'd always tried to fit in at school. Now I'm like the rock and roll kid.
Did they tell you to stop it?
They told me to stop it. And of course, that just encouraged me more.
You'll never work in this school again, kid.
And I was just, that was my first taste of sort of both kind of, I guess, getting a laugh in a, what you might term a, with an audience or in a professional capacity.
Did you find that people were responding to you at school differently?
People would come up, you know, loved you as the comedy reverend.
Right? Like, this guy's funny.
All right, you've seen it now.
Right?
You know, previously, it's just classmates, but now 40 people have seen it.
And how many? Isn't that amazing, the fuel as a youngster that you get when you get those laughs?
Of course.
I mean, as a 14-year-old, that sort of like that acceptance.
Yep.
He's funny. He's got something. And you probably knew, I don't know what this is
right
at that time.
Right.
But this is something. There's Absolutely. Something inside here.
Absolutely.
That's a good feeling. I felt like that too when I was in high school and I did a play. I finally did something and I was such a nervous wreck. And afterwards, you know, and I played a funny role too. And I remember just the popular kid coming up and going, hey, you're pretty funny. And that was like, I was great. Not being me is good.
But it's funny, the compliments don't need to be very big. Hey, you were pretty funny.
Anything.
I'll take it.
You were remotely funny.
Yeah. You were in the neighborhood of amusing. Oh, I'll take that.
Hey, you
much.
Almost made me laugh, Merchant.
Yeah.
Rob, did you ever do anything like that? Like that you said, oh, people are accepting me. I'm good at something. You were a ball player, right? Baseball?
I mean, I played sports a lot when I was younger and then
you know, Steven hates sports.
Well, I got into like art and stuff in high school.
Oh yeah,
and kind
he's
of
a really
music
good photographer. He shoots a lot of bands and stuff.
Moved away from sports.
Now you're 43. I'm 46. Rob's 29. Has a kid, wife.
30, oh, good for you.
30.
You got it figured out.
He's 30. But I mean, isn't that crazy? Could you imagine having a kid like back when you were 29?
I can't imagine having a kid now.
Do you think you'll ever have a kid?
Maybe. I don't want to say never. But
do you like kids?
I like kids. I never hung out with a lot of kids by the time I got to be an adult. I've never spent a lot of time around kids. I know that sounds getting into creepy territory there.
A minute ago when you met my dogs, I felt like you almost hadn't met dogs before.
Well, I tell you...
You like dogs, but you were like, oh, okay, here's your dog.
I get uncomfortable around smaller things. Things that are smaller than me, you know, noticeably smaller than me, that are very low to the ground, are not helpful to me. I'm 6'7". That's a long way down. So children, animals, it's a long way down. You as a, you know, when you were in high school. So I... But with kids, because I never had extended family, like I didn't have loads of cousins and brothers and sisters,
right.
I never just spent time with kids. So I just never, so by the time I was an adult and kids were something you were supposed to want or not want, they just seemed so alien to me. And only recently since I had, my sister had kids and I have a niece and nephew, then it starts to make sense. Oh, I see. Uncle Steve.
Now, do you feel, Uncle Steve, you don't like Steven, do you?
I don't mind. Either one's good.
Does your mother call you Steven?
If she's angry at me.
Okay.
It's very
well, I'm not angry with you.
Steven!
So
in here, now!
So, it's funny because I could see you as a dad.
I think I'd be good.
I think you'd be great. I think you're very patient.
Yes, I am.
Are you extremely patient? Well, it seems like when you work with Ricky Gervais, I mean, I feel like he's not patient.
Right.
Am I right about that?
I think that's fair to say.
Like, I look at you and I think it worked because of the juxtaposition of you two, right?
Right, right.
Did you find yourself being more patient when working with him?
I did. And also, I felt like that was a relationship that would constantly shift in terms of sort of who was the child and who was the adult. Because he has the patience of a child, which I don't think he would deny. And I'm much more kind of, you know, like you say, paternal in the sense that, all right, let's just take a second. We'll just figure it out, you know.
Right.
And but at the same time, he was always very much the adult, I think, when it came to confidence, you know, like you say, dealing with executives or dealing with the kind of the slings and arrows of being professionals in a tough business. You know,
he could do that.
He had the age on me and he could do that. So he constantly shifted, I think, the sort of dynamic.
I feel like you're the kind of guy that if you lost your cool, if you got really upset with someone. You yelled at someone.
Yeah.
Anybody who knows you would go, that's their fault. I didn't hear the conversation,
right.
But I guarantee it's not Steve's fault.
But I'd like to think that was the case. There are occasions when I have lost my temper.
What would make you lose your temper?
I have a problem. It's normally in a professional capacity, and it's normally when someone screws up and doesn't take ownership of that. So they try to bullshit their way out of it.
Blame someone else.
Yeah, I just, that makes me, we all make mistakes, but I think taking ownership of that mistake, and I think that's what makes me, and I think probably sometimes if I'm stressed about something and then there's an incident like this, I think pops up my temper. But I try to keep a lid on it.
Well, I think it's maturity too.
Well, it's also, it just doesn't help. I don't think you help by screaming and shouting. But I occasionally, sometimes I will, or I'll sort of bark at, you know, I'll bark, as it were. You know, I'll sort of...
What's a bark?
Well, you know, that kind of, can we just do it, please?
You know what I mean?
That kind of...
Right, and everybody, that's enough.
That's enough.
You don't need to really, like, the teacher, you don't need to scream.
The teacher just sort of...
Yeah,
you know, just,
I don't get angry really. I think a lot of times people think that I'm just kind of a loud person sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, my family was all loud, so I'll have relationships, and I never really fight, but I'll be like, I don't know why it's... Why are you yelling? I'm not yelling.
Right.
This is my voice.
Right.
Earth, get over here, to my dog.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I'm not yelling at you. I'm just talking like this.
Right.
Why do
you
think this is yelling? Does that sound yelling?
It sounds a little yelly.
See, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But I know what you mean, where you can just dial up a notch, but because you're naturally a louder person, it
louder person. Did you ever snap at Ricky? Did you say, fuck off already?
No, I think the only times it would be things, he would get in a groove where he was... particularly when he was working with Martin Freeman on The Office, he would love to try and make Martin break, you know, during a scene and make him laugh during a scene, and took great delight in that, to try and make Martin, who's an utter professional.
Did you like watching it?
And it was fun, but the problem was sometimes, because I was on the other side of the camera, I'd be conscious the clock was ticking and the time was always against you, as it is in, you know, when you're shooting.
And he would not listen.
And he just wouldn't listen. So sometimes I'd have to be, Rick, please. You know what I mean? I just have to kind of be the teacher to just keep him back.
Just,
you know,
fuck off for a minute.
Let's just get back on track for a second.
And that would probably make him laugh.
Well, of course, that would make him laugh, and that would also encourage him more, probably.
Right. I mean, were you a drinker at all? Have you been a drinker?
Well, not to excess.
I mean, you have a few drinks.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You've never been in trouble with alcohol or anything like that? Never really any problems. You seem like you don't have many issues with that stuff.
No.
You never got into drugs?
No. No, I don't disapprove of drugs. I like the idea of drugs.
Right.
It seems cool. I just never, I'm lucky in the sense, I think that I'm not someone who's had to self-medicate for whatever reason.
You don't need any Xanax to fall asleep when you have a stressful day the next day? You don't need an Ambien?
Not really. No. Very rarely would I use
You can fall asleep like that.
Yes. I can't stay asleep necessarily.
How many hours do you get?
I get maybe six, if I'm lucky, six or seven.
That's it.
I can always fall asleep. Then I'll wake up. I almost always wake up at 6:30. It's weird. I've started taking screenshots of the clock because it's weird how whatever time I go to bed, I wake up at 6:30.
Your body's telling you.
But what's it telling me?
It's telling you go back to sleep 6:30. No, I don't fucking know. I mean, I have a puppy right now, Blanche. So I've been waking up because here's the thing. She's in a crate right now at night. I have to let her cry like a baby. You're supposed to let them cry.
Oh.
Because if you go down, they're like, oh, look, he's coming back.
Right.
So that will be the cyclical thing of going back and coddling the dog, whatever. So, and I think, you know, I can't be more than like 7 hours with the kid downstairs.
Without going and giving
I gotta go let it out.
It,
yeah. I gotta go let it outside. You know, so the piss all over itself.
Yep.
So, you know, I kind of waking up early. And it's not easy. I like to sleep in.
Are you why did you bring up the question about alcohol? Is this something you've had a struggle with?
No, I've never really had problems with alcohol. I think I'm more of a control freak.
Okay.
So I can't, you know, I could have a couple of drinks. I could, you know, I've done some lines of cocaine in my life.
But you don't want to lose control.
Yeah. And I just like, also, I made a joke to you before, like, you know, cocaine, I get really congested.
Sure.
But you know what I mean? I have allergies. So
yeah.
It sounds like such a Jew thing to say. I'm a Jew, by the way.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Oh, good for you.
Rosenbaum. Well, I said that. I don't go to temple. I was bar mitzvahed. I'm a Jew by blood, I guess.
Right.
Are you a religion by blood? Is that right?
I don't know how it works.
How would that even work?
Yes, I don't.
Are you religious?
No, I'm not religious. No.
Do you go to church?
No.
Do you believe in God?
No.
Are all your friends atheists?
Not all of my friends, no.
What kind of question is that?
Are all of your friends atheists?
That's impossible.
But also, it's the fact I've got to quickly run through and think, are they all atheists? Just running through my phone.
I think he might be a
God botherer. I'm not sure.
More importantly, do you want to be friends with people who believe in God? You don't care about who believes in whatever.
I would struggle, I think, if it was someone who was so evangelized that...
Like, you're going to go to hell for this. Right. Yeah, you can't be. That's too much. Crazy. But if someone who believes in something and their family goes to church and they're happy and they're good people, who cares? And your parents weren't religious growing up?
No, not really. I mean, I used to go to church with my neighbors. And then at some point I realized I was only really going to church because at the end of church, while the parents were all saying hi to each other, the kids would go and we'd have a game of hide and seek. And I realized I was really going for the hide and seek. I was sitting through the prayers to get to the hide and seek, and didn't realize. And at some point, I realized that didn't seem like a reason to go to church because right. I could play hide and seek.
I don't know. You get more people to go to church if you started interacting. Exactly. Interactive.
Hang around. There's going to be a hide and seek.
A hide and seek. Go to church.
I only like church because the donuts after when I was little.
What kind of church did you go to?
There's some donuts and coffee.
So out of high school, what did you tell your parents? You're like, hey, I'm going to be a comedian. You knew I'm going to act. This is what I'm going to do. Did they look at you like, fuck off?
My parents were more supportive. I think they thought probably it would be a bit of a phase. And I think all they ever said was make sure you have a good education and you have something to fall back on, right? You know,
literature and
right and
that's
whatever.
Why you're taking those.
Yeah. And so it was actually more, I felt like more my school teachers that thought that was preposterous.
Really?
I never felt that they thought that was a viable
career. Why are you wasting your life? Why are you going that route? There's no money in it, right?
That's right. What they're gonna say. I think certainly there was an assumption where I grew up that being in movies or on TV or anything like that didn't happen to the likes of you. Going back to that idea that, you know, you used to see people that were stars or that people you admired, and they seemed like they were another breed of person who lived in another universe.
Yeah.
And the idea that you could be part of that was alien. And it wasn't sort of a criticism of you. It was more just, that's like saying you're going to win the lottery. What are you talking about? You can't bank on that.
Right.
Right? You have to, you know, you have to do a job of work.
But it's something innately you feel. It's not something that you can describe to someone other than, I know you think I don't look like the movie star. Like, I didn't look like a movie star. I'm the shortest kid. You're the tallest kid.
Right.
We're kind of funny.
Right.
And we're going to go do this. And I was in a small town in Indiana.
Yeah.
And everybody thought the same. I'm not going to amount to shit. If you ask anybody, will Michael Rosenbaum become, you know, will he work in Hollywood? First, who? Michael Rosenbaum?
Sure.
Secondly, they say, oh, wait a minute. That guy, what are you talking? There was just no way that was going to happen. So I understand when my dad said, what are you doing? I understand when people around me were like, you're not going to, why are you doing this? This is like, this is a one in a trillion.
Right.
I mean, you know, I couldn't become a doctor. I wasn't that smart.
It doesn't seem that far off from like a quarterback wanting to go play in the NFL. Though,
yeah, but
they don't.
Yeah, but if you throw a football for 4 years in high school and you're like the best quarterback in the state, then it's like makes sense. But it's not like he does this play and he reads this like about Quarter Milk.
You
know, and he's making people laugh. They're like, oh, he's going to be the next Howie Mandel.
Right. That was the dream.
Jim Carrey, yeah. Howie Mandel.
But I think it was also, what I find odd is that I thought
I
could
say
do
Howie
it.
Mandel?
But I just think, why did I think I could do it? What, you know, that's what's odd.
The thing.
As I say, my parents weren't unsupportive, but neither did they have any experience of show business. So they were sort of neutral on the matter, I think. And so why on earth I had the sort of... Because it's arrogant in a way, isn't it? To think I'm going to go on a stage and try and entertain or be amusing. I mean, it's a weird...
It's a drug. That's what it is. What happened was when you said those lines that night and that audience responded the way they did, it was a drug. It felt so good that you had to get that feeling again. You know what I mean? Isn't that part of it, you think? And that you're like, I like this. I like the way I make people feel. I think I'm funny. I think I could do something with this. No one's like me.
Right.
That's what I started to think, well, not a lot of people around me are like me. So maybe I'm different. Maybe that's good.
Maybe. I'm sure that's part of it. I was a fan of comedy in particular. You know, me and my dad would watch comedy. We watched old movies.
What'd you watch? Know,
I was into Bob Hope, old Bob Hope movies and Laurel and Hardy and all that kind of comedy.
Dudley Moore?
Loved Dudley Moore and Peter Cook.
Yeah.
You know, so I was a fan first. And I guess I would read a lot about those people. And I guess maybe in reading about them, I realized, well, they all had to start somewhere, you know. And maybe sort of understanding a bit about the history of those things kind of made it seem more attainable, maybe. I don't know. Just for some reason. I guess I'm sure that the desire to perform was part of it, but it wasn't just that, because I also liked writing. You know, I liked the nuts and bolts of writing, which is that's not really about showing off writing. There's something else at work there. It's about creating worlds, I think. And I used to draw comic books. And, you know, I think there's something about whether that's a sort of escape from something or a fantasy, or maybe it's a control thing. You're creating these worlds in which anything can play out as you choose it to, right? If real life doesn't quite play out as you'd hope, yeah, in the things you write, you can shape it and control it. I don't know. So sitting in a room writing was something I enjoyed as well.
How did you get into like the radio then? How did all of a sudden, like, you know, because that's like, it's a different medium. You know, you're doing comedy. Like, I guess not. I mean,
I didn't think I realized that there were sort of divisions as perhaps there are. And I think with radio, a friend at school was volunteering at this radio station for this little kind of kids radio project. And he dragged me along one time. And again, I went along and I did something funny. I recorded a little funny bit and they liked it. And it was kind of, oh, great, this is cool. And then I liked radio because, you know, I mean, as you know, with a podcast, you know, we show up in your house and we sit here and we talk and we've generated something, and it's much easier than anything which involves cameras or filming, or which just involves way more people and it's more expensive and it's hard to edit. And I mean, I think now, I mean, the idea now of being a teenager and having a mobile phone in which you could basically shoot an entire movie and cut it on your cell phone. I mean, I'd have died for that stuff when I was a kid.
You think?
Oh, I would have loved it. I was always trying to get my hands on video cameras.
So you like technology?
I like the idea of being able to make stuff.
You know? I think there's something special about that. There's that back and forth feeling of like it's too much. Everybody's videotaping you. The lack of freedom. It's always they're on you. They're
right.
Every move you make, everyone's listening. And it's just to the point where it's become, I don't want to preach, but it's, you know, we're obviously lazier. We don't engage as much. There's lack of connection. I mean, that's people.
No, I don't dispute that. I just mean when I was a kid, the idea of being able to
pick up a phone and film a movie.
Oh my
film
God.
All this. Oh yeah,
I'd have loved it.
Did you used to film movies? Did you used to film little things?
I did, but I just the problem was just the editing was what was problematic. You know, it was easy enough to shoot, but how do you edit? Back in the days when you were shooting on kind of VHS tapes or on tape, you know, to cut that together and make it look like a movie was really hard to do. If I found someone who was at a college where they had editing equipment, I'd beg them to try and let me in. And of course you'd maybe grab an hour here and there, and you know, if you're ever editing something, it takes forever.
Yes.
So I think eventually, maybe when I was at university, I managed to finally get access to it, and we shot like a little gangster movie. It was called The Mark.
Can you find that on iTunes?
You can't find that
on iTunes. Find that anywhere?
You can't find that anywhere.
Would you like to help us find that?
You don't want to see it.
Is it that bad?
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's a kind of it's one of those sort of sub Tarantino, you know, is when everyone was watching Tarantino. It was
a little edge, funny,
gangstery and bad language and kind of kooky humor among the violence, the horrible violence.
Right. Tell me about the day you met Ricky the first time.
Well, I wanted to get into radio because I figured that was a good way to make a living. If you could become a DJ, that's what, 3 hours work a day, you play records, you talk, and then that would give you all this other free time to do other stuff, do stand-up or write a project or whatever. So I thought radio seemed like a good way.
And it paid pretty well?
You know, and I thought, oh, that seems like a good way of getting into the show business.
Right.
Or show business, as we call it. And then I read this thing in this magazine about how a new radio station was launching in London, playing alternative music, and I just sent off my resume, and it turned out that Ricky Gervais was there and got a job there already. And he called me up for an interview and we hit it off. And
what was the interview like?
I think he took me to the pub immediately, sort of 2 in the afternoon. I went all the way to London for it. And of course, again, I just assumed he was older than me. He was about 10 years older than me. He had a job at a radio station. And to me, he was a you know, wow, this is a guy in the business.
And he's doing it.
And of course, very quickly within the interview, he confessed, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. You know, I've sweet-talked my way into this job. I need someone who's going to kind of basically cover my back, you know. And you seem to have a bit of radio experience because I'd done a lot of, you know, just internship and stuff at radio stations. So he hired me. And then I moved to London. And
how long did that last?
What happened was the radio station, there was a lot of build-up to the launch of this station, and I was there with Ricky, and we were kind of planning stuff. We weren't on air, we were behind-the-scenes guys. And then the day before the station was about to launch with a big rock and roll fanfare, Princess Diana died. Nothing to do with us. But
wasn't one of those merchant incidents?
It wasn't the merchant bad luck.
Merchant bad luck, no.
But consequently, as you can imagine, the whole country went into mourning, and it was not a sort of celebratory rock and roll atmosphere into which to launch a radio station. And so the day that station launched, we had to just play somber music and lots of songs that you couldn't play because they might be disrespectful.
That's your first day?
Yeah. I remember there was a Radiohead song called Airbag, which they wouldn't let us play because she died in a car crash. And anyway, so for whatever reason, the station launched to a bit of a whimper. And meanwhile, I had secretly applied for a job at the BBC as a trainee. And so I snuck off behind Ricky's back and did an interview. Actually, no, he knew about it. He gave me permission. And I basically said to him, look, I've been offered this job at the BBC. And I turned it down initially because I was having so much fun working with Ricky. And then I realized, actually, that seems like an error because the BBC, going back to my parents saying, you know, make sure you get something to fall back on in case the show business
BBC,
doesn't work out.
BBC, how do you turn BBC, BBC like, or the you know, pub with Ricky?
Exactly, come on.
Yeah.
So I jumped ship and I joined the BBC and left Ricky in the lurch. But then secretly behind the BBC's back, I would go back every Sunday and do a radio show with Ricky. And I never used my name or got paid for it because I was sort of cheating on the BBC.
Really? Because they would have fired you?
In theory, they could have done.
You couldn't be on. So you went back to work with Ricky.
So he was, by that point, hosting a radio show. They'd realized how funny he was. And then I was his sidekick on there. But I was sort of, I could never use my last name in case anyone heard and put two
what
and two
was your
together.
Name?
I just was known as Steve, I think.
Just Steve. Now, were you guys doing stuff, like, obviously on the side? Like, oh, my God, you really enjoyed each other?
Right.
I mean, you always wanted to hang out. You were always making each other laugh.
Yes,
you were always coming up with ideas. This is what we should do. Did you feel like we have a future together. There's something here. I want to work with this guy. I know he's talented.
There was definitely a chemistry. And that was something that only magnified as we did the radio show. And I think we had a rapport very quickly that I was very excited by. We both were, you know, and I think that became obvious quickly that we kind of were thinking along the same lines and, you know, and that's what you're always looking for in any kind of.
And you were going back because you were enjoying this much more than the BBC.
Well, that was the thing is I remember part of my role at the BBC, it was a trainee scheme. It was very actually, as I subsequently discovered, actually very prestigious and difficult to get on. So I was very lucky. But because I didn't really realize that initially is why I turned it down. Then I subsequently realized, oh, this is actually something of a golden ticket because, you know, Willy Wonka style, I get to kind of see how the chocolate factory works, you know. And so it was really turned out to be a great asset. But part of my responsibilities would be, because I was essentially cheap labor, they'd go and send me on some show in the Midlands that I didn't want to see, and I'd be living in some cold flat, you know, and miserable. I didn't know anybody, and I'd be doing some job I didn't like, and I'd call Ricky, and he'd be sort of boating on Regent's Park Lake at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, you know. And I just think, what have I done? You know, how have I turned this down? But subsequently, he was fired from the radio station, as was I for the radio show.
So why were you fired?
It got taken over by other people, and I think they just thought, why are we employing these people? And then, of course, once the magic of The Office happened.
Now, how did that kind of happen? I mean, you've told the story a million times,
I'm
sure. But, like, I have. But, you know, it's. But that's
Google it.
I will Google it. But
No. What happened was, while at the BBC, I was given a camera team for a day and told to make a little documentary as a.
Right.
Training exercise.
Sure.
And instead of doing a real little documentary, I did a fake one with Ricky.
And that was it?
And that sort of basically became The Office. So we were off to the races, really.
I mean, isn't that just a lucky thing that happened? If you weren't supposed to do that, if they didn't say, hey, this is what we want you to do that day.
But isn't it crazy how when you start to rewind everything? Because if I hadn't seen that thing in the ad.
If you didn't go to Sunday show to do with Ricky,
right.
You stayed at the BBC.
Exactly. Or if I turned the BBC down and I'd never joined it and therefore I'd never got this opportunity to do
the short film. If you didn't say those lines in the play, if you didn't get a quart of milk, if you didn't get the laughs. I mean, let's go back.
Of course.
You're nobody. You're not here right now.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So everything happens for a reason.
No, it doesn't. It's just random chance.
Do you think it's just random chance?
Well.
That goes back to the atheism, doesn't it?
I mean, random chance in the sense that that we're all just, you know, bits of dust floating in the cosmos. That in sense of random chance. In terms of whether any human has any agency, I was obviously trying to get into show business. So I was going out there trying to make it happen.
The energy.
I made some of my own luck.
if sure. you like, by putting myself in situations where these things could occur. If I had just simply sat in my home in my parents' house until I was 40, I'd have been really lucky to have wound up where I am.
Right.
So
I always think it's like an energy, too. It's like, if you know, I always say, you know, when I went to New York, I mean, call it silly. I said, you know, I want to meet Gary Oldman. I'm going to meet Gary Oldman. And first week at a restaurant, I met Gary Oldman. I was like, what? This is the energy. I met Gary Oldman. And we sat there and talked. And it was great. I said, I'm going to meet him right when I get to New York. And somehow I met him. And then I would start thinking.
Did you seek him out, though? I mean, had you heard he might be in this restaurant?
No, I didn't seek him out. But no, one of my friends called me from Carmine's restaurant in New York.
Right. So again, you had made it known.
Gary's here. Gary's at the restaurant. So I don't know. Maybe I didn't. Maybe that was just random.
But I'm saying that because you were putting out there that you wanted to meet Oldman, someone made it happen for
you.
Yeah. And that's the same as me. I was saying to people, I want to do comedy. I want to do a sitcom. I want to be involved in radio and comedy. And therefore, you know, when the opportunity
came, then
they did
it. What would you be doing right now if you just decided not to be an actor? You'd be, what would you do?
If I was not in show business at all? I think I'd like to have been a university professor. Like an academic, writing kind of books that no one really read.
Really?
Just, I liked all that. Yeah, I liked researching and making notes.
What books? What books do you like that no one knows?
Well, you know, obviously since I left university, I'm not reading kind of books about sort of, you know, Marxism as much as I was.
Right.
But I used to like that, you know, where you got assigned a project and you had to research in the library and draw and make notes and develop an argument or a thesis or an idea.
See, I couldn't do that.
I was never into that.
No, see, that's a gift. That's and Ricky probably couldn't do that either, right?
Well, again, I'm not sure he has the patience. He's a smart man. And
I don't have the patience to do that.
Right.
Or the intellect, probably.
Right, right.
I think it's more patience. Like, I think if you just really applied yourself to anything you really enjoy.
A lot of it is patience.
Right.
Yeah.
But I couldn't be a doctor. You think you could be a doctor? I bet you could.
No, because I don't think I understand science. Science I've always struggled with. I understand history and the arts and literature and language, but science, math, I get confused with that stuff.
Do you love the entertainment industry? Do you really enjoy what you do?
I enjoy what I do enormously, yes. But all of the bullshit that people say about the entertainment industry is true. I mean, for instance, you know, when people talk about the sort of cutthroat nature of, you know, Hollywood, I don't think anyone could deny that that's true.
It's true, yeah.
So all of the cliches are accurate. But I think all the joy of it is, that's the stuff that I think sort of slightly underrepresented is, I think a lot of people assume that you do the things you do because you want to win awards or go on a red carpet. And maybe you do, Michael, good luck to you. But for me, I like the mechanics of it. You know, I like the mechanics of sitting in a room and writing a project. And working with people and figuring out.
And the execution.
It's like building a jigsaw puzzle.
You don't care about awards at all?
I haven't won an award since about 2004.
So it does bother you a little?
No, it doesn't bother me, but it only bothers me in the sense that I realize what currency it has, which I never realized.
To get you your next job or get the bigger job.
That's
Does it ever occur to you that maybe you've done it? Like if you look back, you go, wow, I created a tremendously successful franchise, a huge show that won a lot of awards, that made me a lot of money, that I could probably retire. Another show after that. I'm a movie star. I'm doing big movies now. I'm working with big directors. I'm now being seen in a different light. I mean, it's a great career. But like, when does it become, I've done enough? Unless it's just really fun. And I have a hard time understanding how people, maybe not you, but some people, they are always working.
Yes.
And they can't stop working. And if they had the choice, if they had enough money to stop working, if you ask anybody in middle America, hey, you work at Alcoa, where I grew up in Indiana, at this plant, 50 hours a week. And even if they like their job, somebody said, hey, you don't have to work anymore if you don't want to, then no one's going to work.
Right.
Obviously, this is different. We're very lucky
right.
to do what we do
right.
and making movies, but there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of things that come along with it. Do you ever feel like, I'm 43 right now, I'd like to be able to say that maybe when I'm 60, I just don't do anything? Or will you be always doing something?
I do always work. The things that I try to steer towards are the parts of this job that I enjoy the most. Like I say, working with other writers or creative people and sitting in a room and trying to crack a story or figure out jokes or whatever it might be, I find enormously enjoyable. I would do this as a hobby. I was drawing comic books as a kid. I liked it. I liked just doing that, the nuts and bolts of it. I like editing. I would sit there and edit a project. I love that. It's like, it's like a puzzle to be solved. And so
to me, why would I stop? Because I would only do this for free in my spare time anyway.
Ooh, that's really well spoken.
So that's how I feel about it. Now, the stuff that I don't enjoy so much is, as an actor, being, traveling away from home and being kind of having to live in a hotel and that stuff, all of which seemed very exciting when I was when I was young, and now as in my 40s starts to feel
grueling,
tough and wearying and a bit lonely. And so, yeah, so certainly there's, and also I think there's an attempt as I get into my 40s to try and ease off a bit and make sure you spend time with friends and family and loved ones and, and girlfriends. And
so you look out for that. You say, hey, you know what? I'm working 4 months straight. I'm
trying to carve out that space.
I'm going to take a couple weeks off here.
Yes.
I'm going to take a month. You ever take a month off?
Yes, but probably it just means I kind of take my foot off the gas. I'm probably still
can you do that?
Around.
You can do that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't you feel like people are just like you always have to be a part of something? Like you're getting a text even when you're on vacation?
Yes.
Hey, what about this?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it, with the modern technology. You can never escape
it. You never escape it.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the only thing that was pleasing as I was driving up to your house here, I noticed I lost the signal on my phone.
You like that?
And I thought, oh, great. No one can get me. And it's not my fault. So I like being on a plane, on a transatlantic flight.
You don't? Oh, yeah, transatlantic.
Yeah.
But, do you stay, when you go cross country to New York, do you get the Wi-Fi on?
Yeah.
Do you get on your phone so you can just kind of get a little bored?
I like a long drive, though. I like, because you can't check your phone. So you get to listen to, podcasts like your own or whatever.
Like, are you listening to my podcast?
Of course not. But I listen to podcasts like yours.
Oh, you will now. You will now. I get deep.
I'm sure.
I don't get that deep. We know the same person.
Yeah.
I think you live with her.
She's living with me. Yes. We're boyfriend, girlfriend. You mean Mercedes Monroe?
Yeah, I let you say that. Yeah, we did a show together.
She told me about that.
We did in Pastor. Did she say she enjoyed working with me?
She did. She chooses not to talk about you.
She did.
She just says, I don't want to talk about him. No, she does. She did. Yes, she did enjoy working with you. Yes.
Yeah. I was very happy to hear, because she is one of my favorite people in the world.
Amazing person.
She's the heart of gold. I've never seen anyone, like when we work together, I've never seen someone just come to set and just have so much good energy and make everyone feel good. That's and beautiful, if I may say.
Thank you.
So when she said, this was a while ago, she started dating you. And I was like, oh my God, he's a great guy. I don't know if he likes me. I tried to make him laugh, but we did some roller coasters together, but I liked him.
I'd like to confirm that I do like
him. Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good, good. That's good.
Yeah.
You hear that, Rob?
Mm-hmm.
He likes me.
Was that the sole reason that you brought me here today, to confirm or deny?
Well, I wanted to have a conversation. We're done now. Yeah, we're done. What?
That was it. We're done.
We're done. Thank you. Like me, and this podcast is over. No, that was good. And I'm glad you guys are together. I mean, are you one of those people that just, you want to be old and gray with someone? You like to stay with someone? You've always been a monogamous sort of person?
Yes.
Have you always been in relationships?
Yeah, pretty much.
You never were the guy that went out to clubs? I don't see you as a
clubber. I did, but I never felt at home there in that environment. I never felt like that suited me. I was never adept in those environments.
Did you ever play the game? Did you ever go to the clubs and pick up a woman and hang out with her?
Was Hello Ladies autobiographical at all?
I think that was probably closer to my experience.
Was it dating?
Than, the sort of player in the club.
I bet you were cool. I bet they liked you.
But the problem I find with I always found with nightclubs and things was, if I have any strength, it is talking. And you never really talk in a club.
It's so loud.
I mean, it was always so sort of... And I used to look across a club and I'd see someone talking to someone else and they seemed to be having a very intense conversation. I thought, wow, what are they talking about? And then you realize actually that all they're just...
So, where do you work?
I work La Cienega. What?
Where?
I'm at La Cienega.
What? Doing what?
Oh, I work at a bar part-time.
Yeah? What bar?
Oh, excuse me for a second. Hey, John!
Yeah. What bar?
How far? It's
what
right
bar?
Down the street.
What bar?
I have my cars outside.
And it is,
that's what it's like.
So basically all that's happening is that good-looking people are meeting other good-looking people because they don't need language, because you see a good-looking person, you're like, we're good-looking people, let's go. Whereas someone like me, who's a more acquired taste visually,
right,
I need to
convince you that I have some kind of personality, and I need silence. I need a silent environment, which is why I loved libraries. No wonder I was studying so much. I was in the library. Hey, do you come to the biology section much?
Microfiche?
I'll meet you at the microfiche.
Did you ever meet someone at the library and go out?
No.
Never.
No.
How dare they even consider interrupting your reading time?
The idea, certainly through my teen years, the idea of going up to someone, to a stranger, and trying to strike up a conversation with the objective of dating them was madness to me. I just thought that seems crazy.
Yes.
Without some kind of introduction. I guess it like Jane Austen. Have you met Mr. Merchant? You know, I need some kind of, you know, some kind of introduction.
Was there an insecurity in terms of, does this person like me? Have you ever dated do they like me because I'm successful? Or B, are they really attracted to me? Are they going to leave me? Did you ever have any abandonment issues? Did you ever have any like those fears? Or were you always just really confident?
No, that's what I'm saying. I was never, I think I built confidence as I went on and as I had success. Because I think I didn't have lots of sort of self, I wasn't an agonized person. But I think I probably lacked a certain self-worth, or at least in terms of feeling desirable, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And I think career success bleeds into that. You feel like a validity, you feel a certain, so I think it helps self-worth. And then I think then that confidence that you gain from that, like you're saying about energy, you do then exude that back into the world. And I think, you know, I think you, when you're someone who grows up and you watch teen movies or you read that teen books, and so much of it is about the kind of insular wallflower, right, who's just, when will they discover the real me? And then you realize, well, unless you present the real you to someone, how are they supposed to figure it out? What, the girl's just supposed to guess that because you're creepily staring at her from the other side of the room that you're really a poet? I mean, you know what I mean? You just look like a creep. And you realize at some point that, oh, you actually need to sell yourself in some way, right? And so I think once that dawned on me that, oh, actually, you need to present a version of yourself that's...
I'm going to be my charming self. I'm going to be funny. I'm going to say something witty.
Right.
They're going to laugh. Then they're going to start liking me. And then they're going to really see how romantic I can be.
There you are. Exactly. Yeah.
Do you ever get deal with any anxiety or anything like that?
Not anxiety in the sort of medical sense. No, I mean, anxious because I've got to do a TV interview or something. Or
you get anxious. Is that what makes you anxious a little when you do interviews?
Not so much podcasts,
right?
But anything where there's a live audience, I always get a little more jumpy.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think, stand up, you've been doing stand up a long time.
Mm.
Do you really enjoy it? Does it still scare you? You don't like it?
It doesn't scare me, but I don't enjoy it. This is so bizarre. Again, you're talking about the kind of feeding off the thrill of the crowd or the attention or that first experience of being in that play. But that, whatever that buzz was, oh, people are laughing, isn't that great, has given way to, like I said before, I like the nuts and bolts of it. With stand-up, I'm fascinated by constructing the act and making it work and making the bits work. The, you know what I mean? The mechanics of it I find fascinating, but incredibly time-consuming and hard work, and harder than almost anything, because
it is.
You have to go out in front of the audience and you have to go out in the evenings and you sit there anxiously waiting.
That's what I felt.
With butterflies in your stomach, and it's hard.
It is hard.
I saw you do stand-up in Chicago a couple of years ago.
Oh, you did?
And
great.
Both me and my wife, your favorite stand-up comedian. Yeah, she
thank you. That was great. That was I really enjoyed that. But that was by the point at which I'd sort of built the act, you know.
See, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like in the beginning, how do I get them likable, fun, nail them, and then we go on to the storytelling,
right?
Like build it here, and then go into like it is. There's a craft. There's an art.
Huge
art. And I've really I did stand up for the first time last year, and I went up like 50 times at all the big places with all these nuts, Rogan and Apatow and all these. And I just felt like these guys have been doing it forever.
Right.
And I just started. And it was terrifying.
Yeah.
And they were doing it. And they just knew exactly what they were doing.
Well, or they gave the illusion they did.
Maybe.
I think so much of stand-up, which you realize is it's all about, you have to be confident enough, perhaps like in dating, the audience feels reassured. If you show nerves, they get nervous.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's so many counterintuitive things in stand-up. For instance, you know, when you get nervous, you tend to speak faster or gabble, or you want to race to the next punchline because you want to get a laugh. But the skill is to slow down. You know, if you're nervous, if it's not quite working, You don't panic. You go, you slow down, you take a sip of water. You're in control.
That's
you're
the master. True.
You know?
I remember I'd have a drink on the stool. Mm. And I would, I remember just one time, I sort of forgot what I was doing. Mm. Forget, just lost my place.
Yeah.
Packed house at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
You know, I'm feeling that, like, that heat on my face, sure. That flush, yeah. And blushing.
Yep.
You know? And I'm just like, okay, what do you do? And it feels like it's eternity, right?
That's right.
And everybody's looking at you and they're laughing. And you think those laughs are going to start to go down because they're like, is something wrong?
Right.
But it's not that much time. And then you just kind of go over to the stool.
Yep.
You grab your drink and you take the mic and you just put it and you let them hear the yep. little ice cubes flow around, hit the sides of the plastic cup. And then sure. you take the drink of the – and then you – And then they're kind of laughing. They're going, oh, what's he up to? He's confident. He's just taking
Absolutely.
A moment. And I just had forgotten. But I'm like, oh, my God. So there's that. There's definitely yeah.
so
that.
So there's a lot of just sheer technique that you have to learn, isn't there?
Yeah. And
besides on whether stage, or not you're a funny person. Yeah.
Right, right. I will talk about this. I have just this feeling that people are going to see you in a completely different light. And they already are in terms of your acting.
Hmm.
Because I think you've like developed into a really good actor.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
No, I'm like going, holy shit. Like, I think your depth, what they don't know yet, I could see it. I just have this feeling. I've been acting my whole life and I look at you and I could see you playing a role that just.
I would love that. I appreciate that. That means.
I think you could play really dark. And yes. it's so funny because you're like, oh, he's funny. This is Steve. This is the laughing. But now you're getting a lot of roles. Like, people are looking at you differently, right?
Mm.
And you enjoy that.
Yeah, I just did this bit in this movie, The Girl in the Spider's Web.
Right.
Where,
I just saw the trailer for that.
More of a dramatic, another dramatic role after the this movie I did, Logan.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. And I think it's tricky, isn't it? Because, you know, you'll speak to any agent or professional and they'll always say, yeah, every comedian wants to do drama and every drama person wants to do right. comedy. And so I understand it's a bit of a cliche, but I think it is just, as you said, different muscle to exercise. It's a different challenge. The one thing I have always tried to do is at least to keep trying to do something a bit different, you know, and yeah. not just recycle.
That's how we started today.
Right, right.
You know, doing things different, you get bored doing the same thing, right.
And so the drama stuff, and it's a real challenge. It's really, it's hard, it's tough.
But I think, you know, with you, I see someone who knows themselves pretty well.
Right.
Like you have, like, you know, innately, you know who you are.
Mm-hmm. I know my limitations.
You know your limitations.
Which I think helps.
You know, tell me about Jojo Rabbit.
This is a movie I just did a part in, directed by Taika Waititi,
yeah.
who's a terrific Fantastic. Writer, director, and performer. And he's obviously best known probably for that Thor Ragnarok movie, which he wrote and directed.
Or What We Do in the Shadows.
That's right. Terrific.
Absolutely great. I tested and didn't get the TV version.
Just don't. Come on. Let it go. Let it go.
I thought I did well.
But he's done a movie which is an adaptation of a book in which it's a very dark satirical comedy about a little boy during the 1940s who joins the Hitler Youth, and his imaginary best friend is Hitler, played by Taika. And as I say, it's a very sort of black comedy.
That sounds brilliant.
It's great, and it's very ambitious. The tone is ambitious.
When does that come out?
I'm not sure when that comes out, but I played a Gestapo officer, and that was great. And he's amazing. And I was acting opposite Sam Rockwell, who I adore.
Genius.
Just a genius. And again, intimidated by just his brilliance. But lovely man. And again, you know, when you meet someone like that and you work with them and they're a nice person and they're encouraging and supportive, you just raise your game.
Do you ever feel like, you know, when you're, I mean, you talk about a role, you discuss it with the director, but then when you go to do it and they say action, and any of these movies or anything, do you ever feel like, I didn't get it in the first one. I didn't get it in the second one.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
figuring it out right now. I don't know what the director wants. I'm trying to understand it. Am I going to be able to do this?
Yes. Oh, always. Definitely. But certainly in the drama stuff, I feel that. Yeah, I feel a lot more at sea than I do in comedy.
And what's usually the vibe, the feeling, the direction that you know, is it usually they want you to go further? They want you to go deeper?
Always deeper. But I think the thing I've realized is, and I've always, again, because I think I am quite secure in myself, I always am happy to say to a director right off the bat, it's not an ego challenge. It's not me playing an ego game with them. You know, it's me. I'll tell them straight away, whatever you need from me, you know, if you want to give me a line reading, give me a line reading.
I love a line reading.
Then I feel reassured, because I think when you go amiss in any aspect of your life is when you don't admit your own weakness.
Yeah.
You know, the thing.
Be vulnerable.
But the thing I dislike most about Trump of all the many things, and I'm sorry to get political, you may be a big Trump fan.
No.
The reason I dislike him, and it's not even often to do with his politics.
Politics,
it's because I dislike there's a man who has never said he's made a mistake. He has never publicly acknowledged that he's ever in error. In business, in politics, in his private life, he's just always, it's always someone else's fault or it didn't happen. And I just think that the idea of someone who can't take any ownership over...
And how humbling, how humbling.
But who is so perfect that they can't...
But you know what I'm saying is how humbling is it, like as I've gotten older, that my flaws I embrace.
Right.
And I say I'm sorry.
Right.
I didn't do this right, or I apologize for saying this to you, or I did this and I... It feels so much better as a human being for me to just say I'm trying to be the best person I can be. I'm trying to make the...
The people that can't admit weakness... They think they can't admit weakness because it's weak.
Because it's weak.
But it's not. It's strong. It's strong to admit weakness. And it's so bizarre to me that people like Trump in their 70s or whatever haven't figured that out or are so neurotic and insecure they can't.
Well, you've done a shitload of work. You continue to work. Continue to amaze me. Lip sync battle, is that over?
No, that continues to roll on as a show. Yeah.
Well, I'm one of the best lip syncers there are.
You've not done it yet?
No one's invited me. Well, I'm not a big star. No one invites me to this fucking thing. I'd kill it. You'd be like, ah, he was right.
One of the great lip syncers.
Oh, my God.
I'll make a call.
I'm naked in front of my in my bathroom every day, so could I be naked on a...
It's got a family audience.
Yeah, maybe. I won't be naked.
Sure, I think it's probably best.
I'll wear a suit. here's some questions real quick for you. People always ask questions on the Instagram. What is Steven's favorite Carl Pilkington memory? At just the Biebs, Liam Beebe.
Well, I think with Carl, it was, for those that don't know, we did this radio show, as I mentioned, Ricky and I. And, you know, if you've been listening since the beginning of the podcast, you'll recall when we last left our heroes, they'd been fired from that radio station. Well, after the success of our TV stuff, they invited us back and we returned as the conquering heroes and we hosted a radio show. And that was where we were given a man to produce and press the buttons.
That guy was
Carl Pilkington. And Carl, we thought, was just a guy, you know, just a tech guy and a producer guy. And we started asking him questions on air. And lo and behold, it was a goldmine of brilliance. And I think my fondest memory is the first moment we were talking about something on the air. And Carl was telling a story and he said, blah, blah, blah. And the next door neighbors who kept a horse in their house. Anyway, they'd gone away for the weekend. And we were like, whoa, what?
They kept a horse
in the house? And he's like, yeah. Anyway, and he didn't realize that was the interesting part of the story. He just thought that was a bit of...
That's not a big deal.
And then we pursued whatever avenue that was, and we found out about this crazy family with a horse in the house. And I think that was when we're like, oh, this guy's just going to... It's just incredible.
Do you keep in touch? You talk to him a lot?
Of course, I saw him. He was here in LA. I saw him just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, you just think does it make you smile right when you see him?
He's just a sweet man. He's just a great man, a really great guy. Terrific. And I love him.
Do you, I guess in your age, right? Not that you're old, but you like to just hang out. You like to work and hang out with people that you just adore or like, who just enjoy.
Oh, yeah.
We're too old for this shit.
Right.
We got to enjoy people. People who either help us, you know, work-wise and you know, fulfill our dreams, or people that are we're
just
amused
great
by
people.
Them, or good people, good heart.
Absolutely.
At Neostar84, my question for Steven would be, if you could choose another moment in history to reenact on Drunk History, what would it be? Because you played Lincoln twice.
I've done Lincoln twice.
Right?
Yeah,
you're the only person to ever, right?
Well, that's a tricky one, isn't it? Because, where in history? What in history? I think for me as well, it's sort of, one of the reasons I don't like... costume parties, or as we call it in England, fancy dress, is I like, if I'm going to do a costume, I like it to be exact. So if I'm going to play a character from a movie, I want to look like the character in the movie. And problem is, when you're 6'7", you know, with beard and glasses, there aren't, if you think about it, there aren't that many people that you can pretend to be.
Right.
And so there's similarly with history, like I was frustrated when I did Lincoln. In one of them, I had the beard wasn't quite right. You know, I had the mustache on the top lip, and I felt like I wasn't willing to shave it off because I was being a diva, but at the same time, it wasn't appropriate. And so I got frustrated. Whenever I see a clip of that, I'm like, the beard's not right. And so I'm
was
thinking...
Was that your last time on?
That was my last time on. And then I'm thinking, well, hang on, who in history could I play that, you know what I mean, I'm a good match for, that I accurately could be.
You could... Well, you're thin, like me,
right.
But... I look at your facial hair. Maybe even you could do a Teddy Roosevelt.
That would be, yes. Yes, that makes more sense.
See, I can see you because he was a big guy,
big guy. Or maybe Colonel Saunders. Is he a historical figure?
But everybody's been doing him, right?
Oh, that's
it's
true.
It's just
yeah,
over a little too much. But
Wild Bill Hickok? He doesn't have glasses, though.
Well, you don't have to have glasses. But do you, well, then I can't see anything. You need glasses. We can't see shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, can you see when you take them off? Can you see anything? Is it blur?
It's a blur. It's all a blur.
It's a blur.
Yeah.
Why don't you get contacts?
I just feel like at this point, glasses are my shtick. And B, it seems very fiddly. You know, just putting contact lenses in my eyes.
What about that? What's it called? LASIK? That's what I meant.
I'm nervous around lasers. I grew up watching James Bond movies in which lasers were very dangerous. They could cut through steel. A Goldfinger was going to kill Bond with a laser. Why would I put that near my eyes?
At moo.loves, last question. Where's your favorite hangout in Bristol and what's so good about it?
My favorite hangout in Bristol, that's my hometown. Jeez, I don't really, yeah. I mean, when I visit there, I normally hang out with my relatives. So I guess my parents' conservatory, the sort of glass room on the back of their house. Is that my favorite hangout in Bristol?
It could be.
Yeah.
Or the library.
How do you say the library?
How do you say library? How do you say library in English?
Library.
Is it library?
Yeah.
I thought it was, you say it funny.
Library?
How would you say librarian?
Librarian.
It's the same thing. I thought it was librarian.
Librarian?
No, it's not librarian. It's just librarian, fuck's sake. All right, this has been a real treat, man. Thank you for allowing me to be inside of you today.
Of course, as I said before, you're always welcome inside.
Seldom do you find someone who has their shit together.
Yep.
You know, you love yourself?
I don't say I love myself, but I think, you know, we get on.
Yeah?
We get on okay.
Sometimes you're like, hey, you're a good dude.
Yeah.
I like what you do.
I do have a thing which, and this is, again, this sounds like something someone would say who has very low self-esteem. If I disappear off the planet, everyone will be fine. They'll be fine. No one needs me.
I would be very upset.
I appreciate that, but you'd be fine. You'd get on fine without me. You'd be like, oh, that guy's gone. Okay. And then you'd get on with your life. And I feel that most I think...
Well, I think anybody thinks that. Exactly. Certainly Rob.
But I don't know. I think they're probably...
Right?
Yeah, but no one would miss Rob. But my point is...
Yeah, I mean, I'm joking. I would.
I think there's some people who do think they're everything, right? Aren't there some people that believe they're the shit?
They really love themselves.
Don't you think so?
Yes, I think there are a lot of people that really love themselves. I think that you were always striving for that, right? We're always like, hey, I want to be a good human being. I want to say, hey, you know, I'm a good person. I try to be a good person every day.
Right.
I mean, that's important. Do the right thing. Say the right thing.
Right.
Try to help your fellow man. I mean, that's what you do, right? That's what we do.
Try not to be an asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think ending it on that's pretty good. Try not to be an asshole.
If there was a message for the world, it is try not to be an asshole.
Much love. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.